This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Savilla Mann. Coming up, Gordon Evans speaks with Bridge Magazine senior writer Ron French. He recently wrote about Allegan School's academic performance and what it says about schools throughout Michigan. But first, every year, millions of Americans experience eviction. They lose their home, possibly their belongings, and their sense of stability. Many will find a new place, only to be evicted from that one as well. The impact of repeatedly losing your home is the subject of Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Author Matthew Desmond will speak in Kalamazoo this Friday as part of the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together program. Desmond joins us from Princeton University, where he teaches sociology, to talk about why eviction, which he says used to be rare, now affects so many families. Matthew Desmond, welcome to West Southwest.
It's good to be here.
You did your fieldwork for Evicted in Milwaukee. You follow 8 individuals and families who are struggling to hang on to housing and who go through multiple evictions in the course of the book. What's the most common reason these families end up getting evicted?
Because they can't pay the rent. And, you know, we've reached a point in America today where families have seen their incomes flatline, but their housing costs have soared. They've soared all around the country. You know, between 1995 and today, median rents have increased by over 70%, 70%. And so you have this really shrieking gap between what a lot of American families are bringing in and what they had to pay for just basic shelter. And the majority of poor renting families today spend at least half of their income on housing costs, and about 1 in 4 spend over 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. So, you know, under those conditions, eviction is pretty easy.
You're basically one crisis away from not being able to make rent.
You are. And then we might ask, you know, wait a minute, you know, where's public housing or Section 8 vouchers? Where are they in this equation? You know, and the answer is those programs exist and those programs work pretty well, but they're only for the lucky minority of poor families today. So the vast majority of poor renting Americans, about 75%, they receive zero help from the government, even though they qualify for it. And the waiting list for public housing in our biggest cities is no longer counted in years, it's counted in decades. And so, you know, the things that would really help mitigate this crisis are things that you have to wait in line years and years for.
Right. There is a voucher program, but you often have to wait so long for a voucher that, like you said, you could simply be waiting decades to try to get some housing.
Oh, my goodness. You know, in Boston, the last time that the Section 8 voucher list was open was 8 years ago, and it was only open for a couple weeks. You know, I have 2 young kids. If I applied for public housing today in like Washington, D.C., I'd be a grandfather by the time my application came up for review. So when we imagine like the typical poor renting family, we shouldn't think of them living in public housing or getting any kind of help from the government. We should think of the folks that I wrote about in my book, people spending upwards of 60, 70, 80% of their income just on housing costs.
Lack of money is a big reason that people lose their housing in the book, but it's not the only one. Some of the tenants you follow who live in a trailer park, there's a handful of tenants there who are deemed nuisances after an investigation, I believe, by the city. Who are they and what happens to them?
This was a big shocker to me. So, you know, in Milwaukee and in cities all across America, actually, there are things called nuisance laws. And I know they sound boring, but the story behind them isn't. And what they do is they hold landlords accountable for their tenants' behavior. So, you know, if I'm a landlord and you're my tenant and you call 911 over and over and over again, I might get a letter saying, you know, dear Mr. Desmond, your property is a nuisance to our city. And if you don't abate this nuisance, we're going to fine you. And the fines are often scary. The fines have commas in them. And so, you know, I'm in this kind of threatening situation. And usually from a landlord's perspective, I evict the tenant, you know, to kind of abate the nuisance. That's my game plan. Now, a lot of police departments have put these laws in place because they think they address things like partying and loud noise and drugs. But the landlords that I spoke to said, you know, who's calling 911 a lot are victims of domestic violence. And, you know, we did this big statistical study to fact check that, basically, and we found that the landlords are right. Domestic violence in Milwaukee, for example, is the third most popular nuisance that's cited. And every 4 days, a landlord in that city gets a nuisance ordinance for domestic violence-related activity. And in the vast majority of cases, they evict the tenant. Which means we're putting these women in these terrible, terrible situations. We're asking them either to call 911 and risk eviction, or not call 911 and risk more abuse. We have seen movement on this issue, though. You know, the ACLU has started a campaign called I Am Not a Nuisance to kind of fight these laws in the court. And right before the election, after a meeting I had with some senators, we saw federal law being moved back on the side of domestic violence survivors. So we do have good news on the policy front here.
If you're spending nearly your entire income on rent, you would at least hope to have a decent place to live. What kind of condition is this housing in?
It's not in great condition, but it is in better condition in general than it was a few generations ago. And I just think that's important to recognize because, you know, often when we talk about housing and poverty, homelessness, the problems can feel so eternal and intractable. And we can feel like, gosh, we throw all this money at the problem and nothing ever works. And that's just not true. You know, I mean, when we've taken on a big problem as a nation, we've often come up with big solutions. And, you know, the slums were a problem in our cities. You know, kids were dying of tuberculosis in Detroit not that long ago. And we took on a battle with the slum, and the slum was defeated. But that doesn't mean the conditions that a lot of low-income Americans are living in today aren't still racked with problems. You know, I lived in a trailer that didn't have hot water for most of the time. I spent time with families who were living with stopped-up plumbing, pest infestations, lead paint, doors coming off the hinges and falling on children. These are some of the conditions that families are facing. And it matters. It matters not only to things like your health and your children's health, but it also matters to your dignity. You know, if you're paying 70, 80% of your income to rent a rat hole, it tells you something about who the country thinks you are, you know?
And as you explain in the book, it's not as simple as calling up the landlord and saying, you know, excuse me, my fridge doesn't work and there's no stove. And it's not as simple as calling the building inspector either.
It's not. So, you know, if you and I looked at the laws on the books in Detroit or Kalamazoo or Milwaukee, laws that protect tenants, I think we'd probably say, hey, these laws are pretty good. They're strong. You know, in Milwaukee, for example, you can report a landlord to the city. The city is obligated to send someone to inspect your home, you know, and if the landlord has code violations, they can fine the landlord. But, you know, those laws kind of quite literally cost money. You know, if you're a tenant that's paying 80% of your income to rent, you're going to have to ask your landlord for a favor one of these days. And if you're behind and you call the building inspector on a landlord, you greatly increase your risk of eviction, not because it's legal to retaliate, you know, it isn't, but because landlords at any time can evict someone who's behind in rent. And their prerogative to do so might increase if you do get a building inspector coming around. So it's not that tenants don't know their rights. They do. But they know those rights, you know, are not for them in a way. They're only for people that can make rent on time every month, guaranteed.
This is West Southwest. We're speaking with Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted, which explores why eviction has become a common experience for many American families. So how does it benefit landlords to have tenants leaving all the time? I mean, wouldn't they rather have steady tenants?
They would. You know, the eviction crisis is a crisis for everyone. It's a crisis for tenants, and it's also a crisis for landlords who are on the forefront often of the residential instability crisis. One thing that I really wondered going into this book was, okay, you know, if landlords are taking the hit and if it costs money to evict people, why are there so many evictions? And the reason I came up with in the book is that it's cheaper to evict a family than to keep your housing up to code. And those things are linked for the exact reason we just talked about, that, you know, you can kind of fall behind on plumbing or on fixing up your railings or, you know, abating the lead in your apartment. You can fall behind on those things if the tenant is in a financially precarious position, because you know that they're not going to call the building on you most of the time. And so that's the kind of trade-off landlords make. It's also true that landlords in poor neighborhoods take higher risks. You know, they do incur bigger losses. And so what also might be the case that's happening is just landlords increase the cost for all of their tenants because they don't know which ones will cost them losses. And that increases rent burden for everyone and ends up kind of increasing their risk too.
What does happen to these families after they have to leave, after they're evicted? I mean, where do they go?
We did a survey in eviction court, and we asked families, where are you going to go if you got evicted, and most families did not know. They did not know where they would go, which was an incredibly scary finding for us. You know, some families go to homeless shelters, some families go to the street. You end up in abandoned homes. You kind of rely on your relatives and friends, but often, you know, that's asking a lot of them. If you're a renter and taking on boarders can actually be something that is a violation of your lease, you can increase your risk of eviction if you take in a family who's been evicted. So a lot of families are left to get by either on their own or by relying on, you know, people they just met to make ends meet. It's important to recognize that eviction causes all kinds of loss too. You know, you don't only lose your home, but often your kids lose your schools, their schools. You lose your community. You often lose your things, which are taken by movers or piled on the sidewalk and scavenged by neighbors. We have studies that links eviction to job loss, to links it to depression and suicide. You know, and so you add all that up, and it's not just about the link between eviction and homelessness. It's about the link between eviction and all sorts of social ills, which means whatever we care about, you know, whatever issue keeps us up at night, the lack of affordable housing is somewhere at the root of that issue.
Many of the families that you follow have young children, and if anything, that seems to make it harder for them to find housing and to keep housing. Can you talk about that?
So many families I met lived with kids, and one of the most disturbing things that I saw in Milwaukee was, you know, spending time with Arlene, who was a single mom trying to raise two young kids. And Arlene had been evicted, and she was staying with her friend Trisha. And one day, the movers came and just started moving Trisha's things. You know, this was unexpected to Arlene. So here she is, having just been evicted, and in a way, is being evicted again. And her youngest son comes home, Jafaris, and he's 7 at the time. And he climbs the stairs, and he comes upon this scene, right, where there's all these movers, and they're piling stuff in, and his mom's running around trying to find the phones, the chargers, the medication, and he takes in this scene, and he doesn't cry, and he doesn't ask a question or run to get his favorite thing. He just turns around and goes outside to play. And that still really chilled me to the bone. You know, that for some kids in America, eviction is something that's part of their life that they've grown used to. Having a kid doesn't shield you from eviction, it actually exposes you to it. And, you know, we do this study of eviction court, and we learn that what makes a difference between if you're in eviction court and I'm in eviction court and we owe the landlord the same amount of money. What makes a difference is not gender or race or even how much we owe. It's kids. The chance of you getting evicted triple, all else equal, if you live with kids. You know, and so
But why is that though?
because, you know, kids cause landlords headache. You know, they can use the curtains for superhero capes and flush toys down the toilet. And, you know, if they're young, they could test positive for lead poisoning. That can come with a pricey tag if you're a landlord. They can draw the attention of Child Protective Services, the police. If you're living in a segregated community, you don't really have the option of replacing, say, a poor family with a middle class family, you know, or if you have racial bias, you don't have much choice of replacing, let's say, a Latino family with a white family because our cities are so segregated. But you certainly can replace a big family with a smaller one. Or a family with kids with renters without any kids. And that's often better from a bottom line perspective.
This impossible housing situation is just grinding millions of people down. Many of them are children, and you say that it doesn't have to be this way. So why not? What can we do that would be different?
So there's things we can do big and small. And what's been amazing going all around the country is seeing cities just get after this problem with creativity and commitment. You know, you go to Seattle or Lawrence, Kansas. And those are two cities that have learned how to increase the amount of money spent on affordable housing, either through a housing levy, like in Seattle, or through sales tax, like in Lawrence, Kansas. And all that money is going to build stable, affordable homes for families. You know, you go to New York City, who's just passed the right to counsel in housing court. So every family who's facing eviction and homelessness will have a lawyer by their side. These are really effective strategies. But the big kahuna, you know, the kind of the big dose is that we just need a sizable investment in affordable housing programs in America that does need to come from Washington. And so the thing that I advocate for in the book is taking a program that we have that works pretty darn well, the Affordable Housing Voucher Program, and just expanding it to everyone below the poverty line. That would really fundamentally change the face of inequality, and it would drive down evictions and make them rare again.
And you make the case in the book that that's something that we can afford.
Of course, we can afford it. You know, if poverty persists in Kalamazoo and America, it's not for lack of resources. And a good example of this is just the amount of money that's going to homeowner tax subsidies. So every year in the country, the amount of money spent on homeowner tax subsidies, particularly the mortgage interest deduction, those far outpace direct housing assistance to the needy, you know? So the mortgage interest deduction, for example, most of that money goes to families with six-figure incomes. Most white families in America own their home and are eligible for this really sweet deal in the tax code. And most Black and Latino families, because of our histories of segregation and discrimination, they don't. That's really hard to think of like a social policy that more unblushingly amplifies our economic and racial inequality than our housing policy does. So yeah, it's not for lack of resources. We don't have the money, but we've just made certain decisions about how to spend it, who benefits from it. The people that need it the most get nothing, and the people that need it the least get the most.
Matthew Desmond, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Matthew Desmond joined us on Skype. He's the author of Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. It's the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together book for 2018. You can meet Desmond this Friday at Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo. His presentation starts at 7 p.m. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.